The Loose Cannons Podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Right back in the left hand, where it started.
That isn't magic.
What are you talking about? Of course it's magic.
You just kept the penny in that hand the whole time.
You think so?
I didn't know you were funny.
Hey guys, how you doing? You doing good?
Yeah, look good, feel good.
Here for another Loose Cannons podcast coming at you. Discussing my brother's movie, 1999's The Sixth Sense, directed by M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
All right, I'll stop that.
Of course, not as good as my movie that I did with him, The Happening, in case you haven't seen it. Act with the Tree.
Blockbuster classic.
Classic Mark Wahlberg impression.
Guy got eaten by a lion in that movie.
It's in case you're wondering, Mark Wahlberg is not with us in the studio. That's me, Ruben, just doing an impression, and Patrick joining in as well.
Uncanny.
And an impression of Dan Van Kirk doing an impression.
Mark Wahlberg.
And joining us for the first time in a while, it's Ilya.
Yeah. Hello.
Welcome back, Ilya.
Thank you. So good to be back.
Also, welcome back, Basil, who was here last week.
Yeah, here I am.
Welcome back, everyone.
Except Mitchell. See you later, Mitchell.
Wouldn't want to be
soon enough.
So yeah, we're going to be discussing more AFI Top 100 films, Sixth Sense, today. But before we do that, let's discuss other films that are worthy of extreme praise, or possibly extreme not praise. Patrick?
I don't think I have anything to
herald or denounce.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything to herald or denounce. Oh yeah, we didn't.
Do our little
horn intro there. I don't think I have anything to herald or denounce. There's stuff I want to talk about, but I want to, like, save it now. Like, I think I'm feeling like
that's cool.
Saving some end-of-the-year stuff, and mostly what I've seen is...
stuff.
Yeah, I guess I will say that, I don't know, I wasn't enough underwhelmed. The only other thing I've watched is I rewatched My Best Fiend, but I was just really in the middle on it, so nothing to herald or denounce there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, Klaus. You're not extreme enough for us. I will. I'll throw a curveball to audience members, maybe, and herald Iron Man 2.
Whoa.
Yeah. I've just been sitting around my house a lot lately, so I watched The Avengers for the first time in a really long time, and then I was like, I'm going to go back and watch all the Marvel movies I haven't seen in a long time, even though I don't particularly like them. So I started doing that, and I watched The Incredible Hulk, which I liked, but not as much as I used to. And then I watched Iron Man 2, which I used to hate, and now it is apparently my favorite Marvel movie, which I feel very weird about, but... I don't know. It starts off really, really strong. It dips a little bit in the end, but I was, like, so into the, like, first, like, 30 to 40 minutes that I was like, well, I'm still on this train. I still like this movie. Jon Favreau with Matthew Libatique actually makes, like, a pretty good-looking movie, which I wasn't expecting, because even Iron Man, which Libatique also did, looks pretty bad to me. Like, the look of it hasn't aged well, but he kind of gets away from, like, the more corny comic book aspects and just shoots it like a regular movie, and some of it looks very, very cool. And Mickey Rourke is a fun villain.
Yeah.
I really like his phony Russian accent. It's very silly, but the way that he just like looks at people is very cool. He looks like he's just completely indifferent to their presence with him, and also like amused at the idea that they think the two of them are having a conversation. Like, it's like this strange sort of just bemused, like, you're nothing to me, and it's funny to me that you're just talking to me like you're on my level. And I think that's a fun way to be like kind of a quiet villain, where he's not exactly like intimidating, except that it's sort of inherently scary how indifferent to other people's humanity he is. It gives him a real sociopath vibe without like hitting it over the head. I was into it. And RDJ like leans into the narcissism aspects of the character in a way that I found pretty funny and more like not trying to be as charming. It's like, oh, like Iron Man's like a real dick, and this movie's like not that into how big of a dick he is anymore. Like in the first one, it's like, oh, this guy's kind of a dick, but it's kind of charming what a dick he is. And it's like, no, this person's just really ruining everyone around them's lives by being so annoying. Self-obsessed. I dug it. I mean, nice. Not a lot. I'm not loving these Marvels, but since until very recently, I hadn't given a single one of them 3 stars. Feels nice to finally see a couple that I was like, these are 3-star movies. This is solid. And if not for like kind of dragging in the end, this one would have been even higher, like a 3.5. So it's a high 3 stars.
Mm. All right. Well, speaking of curveballs, I've been watching quite a lot of movies lately. And one of the ones that I wanted to talk about was American Sniper, which I liked a lot more than I thought I would.
Nice.
And the case for it being, I guess, like a propaganda, like American hero, whatever, goes to Iraq, kills a bunch of people, how awesome, is, I think, kind of a weak case in this movie. Because, I mean, for what it's worth, Bradley Cooper is presented to be like the most typical kind of like Texan American dude who's just like doing like rodeos and whatever, like in his free time. And then kind of out of nowhere gets drafted or like decides to sign up and go to Iraq and then start shooting people. Very first thing he does is he shoots a kid and his mom.
Wow.
And he flinches a little bit and he's like kind of disturbed by it. But then he goes on to murder like another 150 people. And the thing that comes throughout the whole movie is like he keeps like going back and his wife is complaining that like he's not returning to his family. But isn't it supposed to be strange to come back after murdering 150 people and just go on with your life as if nothing ever happened? And that the fact that that is expected of those people is really weird. The fact that like the normalcy, like the level at which the movie sets like normalcy, is really strange and disturbing. And I thought it was actually a pretty effective way of communicating what like the United States kind of expects from its army and
heroes.
It's like the people that it sends over to kill a bunch of foreigners. And the fact that the movie never even tries to like make a person from Iraq like seem like a human, I think fits very well with this, because none of those people seem to think of them as humans. There's like an ongoing thing about everyone that goes over there like doing it for the homeland and doing it to protect like the US from those kinds of people ever going over there to blow anything up. But that also sends a signal like they don't really give a shit about what's actually happening in Iraq.
Yeah.
They don't care. Like, none of it matters to them. And a really neat scene with a psychologist where he asks him like how he feels about having killed 150 people. Bradley Cooper's like, I wish I could have saved more. Basically equating killing people with saving his own.
Lives.
And I think that that's also like a pretty intense like thing to transport. So I don't know, like besides that, there's a lot of pretty effective set pieces. There's like a neat little sandstorm sequence that people talk a lot about that has like kind of dated CGI, I guess, but is like really well done in general. Like the, I like the fact that a movie eschewed like any kind of like super emotional scenes of people dying or whatever, because nobody really cares that much about each other in this movie. And I thought that I was pretty impressed. I thought it was a really good war movie, a really scary war movie about how the most simple seeming of people can do the most outrageous and horrifying acts within war. So, thumbs up from me.
Damn you, Clint Eastwood.
I don't know. I don't think I agree with that assessment necessarily. I do think he does actually do a good job of like exploring PTSD, but I don't think that he has enough distance and like awareness of all the problems with the war scenes, because the way that they're directed is like an action movie and you're supposed to be rooting for the Americans. Mm. They like kind of hilariously over villainize just everyone from the Middle East, just everyone from every country in the Middle East.
Yeah, I guess that didn't seem to bother me that much because it seemed to be from their perspective, which I think is pretty true. Like, they would villainize those people in order to do what they did. They would villainize
the movie doesn't ever come down on anyone for it, though. Like, it's just like, oh, it's so sad what happened to Chris Kyle. It's because of PTSD.
Let's play Despacito.
Yeah. I feel that's fair. I'm just like, I'm not even gonna like psychologize Eastwood's like position on it. It might be quite different. It's just like from what I could see and what I feel about the whole thing happening, it was a pretty accurate depiction of what like the people that go there seem to think that they're doing, which is they think that they're doing acts of heroism and they think that they're saving like the homeland, but what they're actually doing is completely different. But they don't really seem to give a shit about it. And I think that that movie really depicts that pretty well. But, you know, good.
We've talked before about succeeding in spite of whatever authorial intent was.
Yeah, right.
Please revisit our Platoon podcast for a similar argument.
Yeah, indeed.
Different war movie.
Yeah. Where I seem to probably, I thought in that podcast, I probably took like a different stance. And I guess I kind of moved into this other stance where I don't give a shit about authorial intent.
Things can.
Yeah.
That's how I feel too. I mean, I didn't like Platoon, but I could see myself liking a different movie where I felt similarly about what they might be trying to say and how I felt about it. I mean, to go back to Iron Man 2, I don't know whether or not Jon Favreau is intended to critique Iron Man as much as I felt, but I was like, wow, this guy fucking sucks.
Ruben?
I was hoping to throw a curveball as well and herald John Carpenter's Starman, but it's not, the second half of the movie isn't as good, so I guess I'll do the opposite of a curveball and denounce Spider-Man Homecoming.
Well, Julia Mitchell,
which is, they've taken stuff from a bunch of other sources and just sucked the life out of it. It's like the most corporate of a corporate series of movies. Like, nothing about it feels real or lived in at all to me. There's a scene where Peter Parker isn't being Spider-Man, and it's like there's even a part where he like raises his hand and a teacher points at him to answer a question. I'm like, okay, so you've watched Spider-Man 2? Like, almost all of the like humor from it comes like straight from like Vine and memes and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, but that's like young kids, mostly of color, like figuring out and perform and like having fun. You guys have just processed and repackaged something that was really exciting, and in order to sell it back to those tweeners who made
with
it
the
for
face.
You, yeah, to the white face, who's very attracted to black women, which is a little weird thing about this movie that's never commented on.
Really weird. Yeah.
And yeah, you know what everyone says about the politics is true as well. Michael Keaton's Vulture character gets a speech near the end of the movie that is very right, but he's the bad guy.
Yeah.
It's not really, it doesn't feel like they think that he's wrong, so it's not really explicable exactly why he's the bad guy. I guess they're centrist, he does it too much. When you do good too violent, that's bad.
That's it. He does too much violence.
Yeah.
There's violence
he
on
should
both
do
sides.
It peacefully.
Should
take down the system peacefully.
It's interesting, like, I've heard criticism about the new Spider-Man game that was like, well, Spider-Man is basically a narc in that game. Like, he just, like, he's there to help cops, and that's all he does, and cops are his friend, and, like, wow, I really don't, I guess cops. Maybe Sam Raimi's Spider-Man series just really, like, disassociated itself from that whole aspect, and that's why I like it that much, but, like, otherwise, maybe this character is just kind of garbage.
One really nice part about the second half of Starman is when the local cops find Jeff Bridges' alien, and like the FBI calls him in and it tells them to like sit and wait for them to arrive and not do anything. And they're like, well, what if they approach us? And it's like, well, if your life is in imminent danger, obviously you can protect yourself. And then like they shut off the thing. He's like, I feel like our life might be in imminent danger. And then they try to break into their car, the cops, in order to start a fight with the alien, and I'm like, John Carpenter knew what was up.
Yep.
Cops are bad.
Yep.
Cops are bad. Speaking of, you want to tell us the plot of The Sixth Sense, Ilya?
Oh, hell yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Ah, shit, yeah.
The most famous twist of the last 50 years.
Don't listen to this unless you know what's going to happen, which is that Bruce Willis realizes that he's surrounded by millions of other Bruce Willises, that everyone in this movie is Bruce Willis. That's the twist at the end of this movie. So it's the story of a child psychologist, Malcolm Crowe, who is his house is broken into by one of his former patients, a kid that he used to treat, who shoots him. And then it cuts to him working a case of another kid, played by Haley Joel Osment, who seems to have like all sorts of troubles. And he kind of starts to like try to talk to him and figure out what the thing might be, and as it turns out, Haley Joel Osment is visited by ghosts of people that died, and he sees them every day, all the time. And Bruce Willis starts working with him and helps him sort of like go through and figure out what to do with the situation. And as it happens, it also reveals Bruce Willis's own state. So, what do you guys think?
The state of death.
Yep.
I felt similarly as I did about The Village, but less strong about the aesthetics, and that this movie is even stupider than that one. So I ended up kind of like in the middle, because I didn't think that Shyamalan's very good camera work was able to cover up for a lot of the things that is lacking from the script. Patrick.
I actually liked this movie. I didn't think that I would, but I thought that there were some actually good performances in it. Like, I actually do think Haley Joel Osment's performance is really good in this movie, and I was like, well, it's...
I like Olivia Williams
pretty,
a lot.
Yeah, I was surprised by how much I enjoyed this movie. I was like, okay, it's... Like, I don't know, it just gets to the point pretty quickly, and I was like, that's good. I don't find it scary at all anymore, but I also think it's a lot funnier than I remember it being, too. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I like this movie a lot. As people on this podcast know, I've had a pretty rough week. And there's something about the metaphor of this that hit me in a really hard place that made me feel really sad. Where I was like, oh, this is like ghosts as like this metaphor for like trauma that people inflict on each other, which I guess is like a pretty common metaphor for ghosts. But like, I don't know, there was something about the kind of reveal and when Haley Joel Osment starts trying to actually communicate with the ghosts instead of just being scared of them, where I was like, aw, fuck. Like, it just, like, it created this kind of, I don't know, like, eye of the storm where my mind just, like, went out to, like, ways that I've hurt people in real life and just, like, the ways in which everyone on the planet is, like, hurting each other pretty badly all the time. Like, we're just causing each other suffering. And I was like, fuck, this is sad. Like, this movie's making me deeply sad. And it worked for me. And I also think that there's something very strange. Like, it makes me sad a little bit that Shyamalan became, like, the twist guy. Because I feel like this movie's twist, at least for me, is, like, the smartest way to do a twist. Like, it's like a new way of doing a movie twist where you're using cinematic convention to paper over the twist as opposed to just like narrative, like the way in which, you know, cutting around scenes makes the audience infer that a scene has happened before it, before you get to the spot, and that like makes you not think that the twist is coming because you've created like narrative spaces that it turns out don't exist, which is like movies because those scenes don't actually exist. You just made them up in your head.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Your brain know? Like filling in the gaps.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is pretty good.
The, you go next.
Oh. Yeah, sure. I like this movie too. I thought it was an interesting addition to the AFI Top 100 list, to be honest. I was like, yeah, how come this made it in? And then I looked up, it had a budget of $40 million and it earned $690 million.
Yeah.
So it's like one of the most successful, like low-budget movies of all time. And that makes sense because the AFI Top 100 is mostly also like a list that confirms like commercial cinema. Like, it's like, oh, movies that make a lot of money get to be on this list. And I think it's, I've forgotten, because I haven't watched this movie in a long time, I've forgotten how, like, the storytelling is really kind of calm and slow. Like, a lot of scenes just sort of happen, and not much in the way of action happens in those scenes. Like, a lot of it is just, like, people in rooms talking to each other, and then, like, that's it. Like, Bruce Willis's character is like really, his performance is really weird, like really low key and mostly playing with like expressive like eyes and things like that, which, I mean, I'm not sure Bruce Willis is really a great actor, but he seems to fit this role pretty well. I also, like Patrick said, I also really like Haley Joel Osment's performance in it. I think in general, he has a pretty good track record of being really good in movies when he was a kid. Like, the other one performance that I think comes to mind is AI, and he was awesome in that as well, so that's pretty cool. Usually kind of disturbed by
30 Seconds and Forrest Gump.
In Forrest Gump, yeah. Exactly.
The small role he has in Forrest Gump.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, the pace at which it all goes is interesting. I don't know. It was like a much more... Like, I think narratively, there's, like, from the script that Ruben mentioned, there's quite a few things that, if you really think about them, don't really make sense. Like, there's a scene where once Haley Joel Osment figures out that he can help the ghosts, he can help, like, the dead people come to peace. The story that ends up happening after that is the girl that secretly films her mom poisoning her, or like this woman. I don't know if it's her mom poisoning her.
It's her mom.
It's her mom, yeah.
And I think that that's like a really well set up thing, but I'm not sure it actually makes sense because, like, why did she do all that and not ever show her dad or like anything? Like, I think it's an effective and powerful scene, but it doesn't really hold water once you really think about what would happen if someone went through all that trouble and all that scheming and then just let the person kill them instead of save the VHS under their bed rather than like just showing it to her dad or something. So yeah. So I think the plot, if you really scrutinize it, doesn't really work. But otherwise,
the psychology major take over there.
That has nothing to do with psychology. I remember what I was going to say to Basil, which was like, it was really apparent to me watching this film how many things that are now popular in horror films and in indie films that like this movie like started. I was like, oh.
Right.
This movie gave like voice to like so many things that people just like love, which also is another reason probably why it's on the AFI. I feel like it was just like an immensely popular movie that people are like, it's super good, you have to say that it's the best. Kind of like Dark Knight, but maybe a little less annoying. Personally for me, my problem with the script isn't like, I guess, plot holes. I mean, I do think it's a little weird that Cole is not scared of Malcolm.
Bruce Willis.
Malcolm.
Yeah.
Malcolm.
Right.
Yeah.
The very first time that he meets him, and like you could easily fit that into the narrative of the script without seeming out of place. So it seems like that seems like kind of a misstep. My problem was with the dialogue, which I think is a lot of it is very goofy and bad. Like the first scene between Olivia Williams and Bruce Willis kind of sets me off on like a bad foot, and it's like, how much for a fine frame like this, a fine frame that's as fine as this one? And she's like, you talk like Dr. Seuss when you're drunk. And I'm like, this is the kind of thing that a freshman in college would write. Like, really nailed it.
Yeah.
Because like no one in real life talks like this. This is like people trying real hard to be witty. It's like the thing that Joss Whedon gets accused of the most. It's like this kind of inhuman, cutesy dialogue.
Cutesy,
the movie is like littered with like stuff like that where I'm like, I don't like that.
Yeah.
I don't like the way that people talk in this movie a fair amount. And like, you know, obviously in The Village, you've got like a pretty compelling reason as to why everyone talks in such a silly manner. It's like a way to like sort of, you know, meta reason for dialogue being bad is because there are parents who've learned everything from movies that told them to talk this way. Spoilers for The Village.
Oh no, I never watched The Village. There you go.
But, what was I going to say?
Well, just as far as that scene though, with the girl, I guess, like in my head, the explanation is she was recording her puppet show or whatever, and maybe she was like planning to like give it to the dad or the police or something, and she just died before she could do anything.
Yeah, I feel like the way it's set up, at least for me, my interpretation of it was that she accidentally captured this happening, because it seems like she just kind of bumps the playhouse as she's getting into bed, that it wasn't like necessarily this
it wasn't a sting like operation furtive. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, she pulls away that like play thing just before she goes to bed.
I thought she was putting it down so her mom wouldn't be mad that she was out of bed. Like, I thought that was the whole implication, was that she wasn't supposed to be out of bed playing around.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was how,
that's
I
how
saw
I read
it, too,
it as
was
well.
But yeah, my problem, I do still have a problem with that scene, which, I mean, I think comes to the pacing of the movie, which I agree, like, is set up very well, that, like, it really takes its time, but then is like, oh, we're shooting for, like, an hour and 40-minute movie, so now we gotta wrap this up really fast. So, like, the whole emotional payoff of that scene, like, comes really, really fast, where it's like, he gives the videotape to the dad, and then the dad just is like, I'm gonna watch this videotape right now at this funeral, and then it was like,
yeah,
and then watches it, and then like puts it together very quickly that his wife like murdered their daughter, and then like, you know, confronts her right in front of everyone. Also, and it's like, this is a lot of like emotional beats happening in a very short amount of time, and it's because we need to wrap this movie up. We don't need, we can't like
yeah.
take the time to have it make. Like a more
yeah, because right after that,
logistical sense.
Yeah, Malcolm is like saying to Cole, I guess we don't have to see each other anymore. Like that, right. That's it. Like, okay, cool.
Yeah, and same with the, you know, like the play, like it's, there's no explanation as to why he gets cast as the lead in the play, and the
no.
like rude bully actor kid gets
the shitty kid.
He used his knowledge of the past to trick people.
Yeah. or something. I just think that scene's so funny because the other kid comes up and says something and he's like, silence, village idiot! It's like...
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I love this movie. It's
that's
like, it's,
not how bullying works, by yeah, the way.
But it's
bullying just continues forever until you're out. That's it. That's how bullying works. It doesn't just stop at some point.
I just something that's extremely like goofy and obvious about so much of this that like made me think it was so funny this time around. I remember when I watched this the first time when I was in like high school or whatever, I actually didn't think the movie was scary, and I was like, whoa, there are moments that just like make you jump out of your seat. And like this time there was absolutely nothing that I thought was scary about the movie, but like watching it, I don't know, there's something about its like goofy obviousness about everything that's going on, especially like knowing the twist of the movie. I was like, I don't, it's something endearing about it a little bit. Like it just seems like, I don't know, like a weird like Shyamalan-y like quality to it, like that I think I see running through all of his movies, where he's like extremely earnest about
so earnest.
Very yeah very like
yeah
very goofy things, and I'm just like, I kind of connect with that on whatever level, and I'm just like, I just have fun, you know, watching your like goofy earnestness about these weird things.
But I also like how it depicts a relationship with between him and his wife that is like based on them not talking to each other, and we're like so used to like a depiction of couples that are just like, oh yeah, they just don't, they like go to a restaurant but don't talk a single word to each other. That's normal. Like, as if that really happens a lot in life. I don't think it really happens a lot. But since we're like, what Basil said at the beginning, like the narrative conventions are like so beat into us at this point that it works.
And I actually think, like for me, Olivia Williams is the best performance in the film, because like it's really like that scene is like, to me, pitch perfect from her, because like when she delivers the line happy anniversary, like it can seem smug and condescending on first viewing, and then when you watch it again it's like very sad.
Just
it's
sad,
like how
yeah.
did she, it's like how did she nail both of those emotions at the same time?
She's
where
good.
You could, where you could read it so completely differently. And
exactly.
I think so much of like the movie being able to deliver on the twist on first watch 20 years ago has to do with her ability to land a scene that's extremely strange to act, which is like, all
right,
we want you to play it as if you know he's there, but also he's not there.
Yes. that Rosemary Cross is very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was killing it in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also love that scene where she sells the couple the ring to that ring. I was like, this is a very good scene because she's both like trying to seem like she's I don't know, like
she's kind of theme exposition.
Yeah, well she's like I'm, you know, I understand your situation and I want to be I can't think of the word that I want to use for it, but empathetic to the situation of the husband, but she's also like really like putting him in that situation where it's like, but you're gonna buy this ring, right? It's like, it's a nice fine line to walk where you both seem empathetic but also like are really pushing
this, like, that scene made me very uncomfortable. I was like, this is really sad, like,
yeah,
that guy clearly can't afford this ring.
Yeah,
and he's not even the number one choice of the woman he's gonna
make. I think another level maybe worth discussing is I think something that's kind of run through Shyamalan's filmography, which makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I don't know how far it's really been discussed a lot, but maybe it has, is like his kind of aversion to any kind of disability, be it physical or mental. So in this movie, it's not maybe as obvious as in like Unbreakable, where the villain is literally the villain because he is disabled and he does everything that's evil because he has his condition. In this movie,
they
call me
Mr. Glass.
Yeah. In this movie, I think it's a little bit different because there's a scene where basically Bruce Willis starts talking into his like speak phone or whatever. And he says like, oh, I can't help this kid. He's like far beyond anything. He's like, his condition is like, he needs to be hospitalized and blah, blah, blah. And ironically, once he realizes that, oh, he actually sees dead people, then he can help him. Like, then he knows what to say. But he's a fucking child psychologist. And like, a kid having like a lot of problems is like, oh my God, I can't, this is impossible to deal with. Nothing possibly can help this child.
Schizophrenia.
But luckily he actually sees dead people, so then we can help him. So I think that's a bit weird. I don't know how you guys felt about that.
I guess I had a more generous reading of maybe both movies, but I'll start with this one, which was, to me at least, like, I wasn't in that moment when he's recording himself or whatever, is like, I thought that, especially knowing the twist or whatever, I was seeing Bruce Willis's character this guy's like a failure right now. Like, he is, you know, I mean, he admits that he's failing, but I didn't think that we were supposed to feel empathetic to him in that moment. Is like, he has such a narrow view of what his job is and what the world is that he can't like reach out to this other person and connect with them. Because, for one, like, he is caught up in the kind of tropes of his profession. And it's like, a child is reaching out to me and telling me things and trying to connect with me. And his reaction is to, like, distance himself through, like, jargon and through, like, his profession and be like, this kid is clearly crazy, instead of, like, this person. Like, you know, it's just like a, I don't know, like, I mean,
another person in pain.
What's that?
I said another person in pain.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'm a person in pain. This person is a person in pain. And yeah. And just like to, you know, I guess like how you connect with people and really help them maybe is to like, meet them on their like emotional level. It's like, this little kid is like having all these issues, and the way to, you know, like he's putting all these layers of abstraction up instead of just being like, what does this kid need and how can I?
Yeah, though the pivotal scene of him like actually taking him seriously is when he listens to that tape and he actually hears the voices of dead people on that tape, which is also a fucking ridiculous scene, but like, okay. So only after that does he really take him seriously. Before that, it's just like, oh, this kid is just like, he's beyond help. Like, he, nothing I can do here as a psychologist.
Yeah, I think
I cannot possibly do anything.
The movie does a good job of like establishing that push-pull though between Bruce Willis actually like coming down to his level, because that very first scene where he's like, let's play a game, is basically just Bruce Willis being like, was like, haha, let me use my fancy tricks and I'm going to show you how much I know. And like, he's basically just showing off at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at the end, it's just like, oh, you don't really know anything, do you? Like,
yeah, he's using his knowledge of past similar cases in order to, you know, not read his mind, but just make educated guesses about the situation.
And the only
as soon as he tries to guess on something specific to him, which is the watch,
he doesn't
know him.
Yeah. And the only time that he ever really gets through to him is when he just like basically brings himself down and shows how much of a goofball he is, because he like does the really lame trick with the penny and then he tries to tell the bedtime story that's really terrible. And I was like, this is the only way that he can actually connect, is by like pulling himself down off of his pedestal and like actually, you know,
throw that fine frame in the trash.
Yeah, throw that fancy award in the garbage. Like, come down here and actually, like, you know, get on this person's level and like try and understand them.
I really like the double meaning in their first meeting when he says, "Are you a good doctor?" And what he means is, "Are you?
I used to be
ethical because you're a dead person and I'm terrified of you." But as well as means, "Are you competent at your job?" And he's like, "I won an award
from the mayor."
The double meaning of good there.
From
the mayor. That's to me the best like cute writing moment of the movie.
I also like the. I mean, it's set in the Philly. I really like the scene in that house when Cole gets invited to that kid's birthday party, and like all these parents are just awful people. They're just like these rich fucking assholes who have like no idea of I don't know. They like seem really arrogant and weird, and
a lot of that's the costuming, which is pitch perfect.
Yeah.
And that's how different Toni Collette's mom looks from all the other moms.
From all the other moms, exactly. There's like a weird, interesting thing that runs throughout the movie as well. Like in that scene and in a scene before in the school when he confronts his teacher and he tells him, well, actually, that in that courthouse, like they used to hang people a lot. And he's like, what? No, there were just like a bunch of lawyers running around. Yeah, they're the ones that hung people. What? No. Who told you that? Like, did one of these guys tell you that? They're probably kidding. It's like this weird, interesting thing about like how like modern society is like so ahistorical. Like, they don't give a shit about it. And Cole is like reaching through, like trying to like use historical arguments about something, and it's just like not coming through to anyone. That's like a neat bit of commentary that doesn't really go like very far, but I thought was like an interesting thing. Like everyone around Cole seems to be like not interested in the past very much. It's just like, who cares what used to happen here and what these people used to do here? We're in the now. That matters.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that's
interesting. Yeah, I mean, I agree that it's just a one-off moment, but it is an interesting thing of like, of course, that's exactly what, like, that's lawyers' jobs, is to put people in prison or put people to death. And that, you know, when we talk about history, it's like, oh, these great people of history, these great, attorney generals, those people who were in charge of making sure that the proper people got executed for their crimes.
Yeah.
Other terrible things. It's very accurate. This is sort of switching topics, but I really appreciated that M. Night Shyamalan, like, he knows that the audience knows what the movie's about. Like, they don't use the word ghost until after the dead people's speech. But the way the movie is shot, and there's like no ghost, like real ghost appearances until after that. But the way that the movie is shot, there's like ghosty stuff happening like immediately. And like even like from the first moment that Olivia Williams shows up, she's like pulling the wine bottle and it's just like a spooky scene. And, you know, you're expecting some kind of ghostly thing to happen in that moment already. And I feel like That's a pretty cool thing to do, because I feel like a lot of times, you know, movies operate with the assumption that you're just walking in blind and you know nothing about the movie, and then they can take like a lot of time like setting up what their premise is. And from this, it's like, this movie's called The Sixth Sense. Our marketing's probably going to reveal that it's about ghosts, so let's start from the idea that the audience already knows they're watching a spooky horror movie. And even like later when Haley Joel Osment, his first appearance, like Bruce Willis is sitting outside in the park and the apartment door opens, and it makes sense character-wise, so I was like, oh, this is a smart thing that like Haley Joel Osment is like scared of the outside world. But like the door opens and Haley Joel Osment doesn't appear right away, so it looks like it could just be like a ghost opening the door. Mm. And then finally his face like comes around the corner, and then he like slowly goes outside. But I was like, oh, that's spooky already. Like, but it also isn't just like unjustified spooky. Like, it makes sense with his character too, and I was like, that's cool, dig it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And smart.
I also think, to go back to the I guess like the sort of plot hole reason of like, why isn't he scared of Bruce Willis's character? It seems like most of the time what he gets scared of is not actually like the ghosts themselves being like aggressive toward him, but it's just like the way that they look. Like, it'll be like, you know, like somebody turns around and the back of their head's blown off, or,
yeah,
you know, like,
but when, where the audience isn't seeing Bruce Willis the way that he is, he would probably be seeing him.
Right,
with
right.
The big
but even that wound, like, would be like covered up by his jacket or whatever. Like, it wouldn't be like a, like outwardly, like he's not like vomiting the first time he shows up, like Misha Barton's character is, or anything like that. And so it's like, it may have been a thing where he's kind of like looking at him like, what's going to happen with this ghost? And he does like a little bit kind of run away from him at the beginning, where he's like,
yeah,
kind of walking really quickly into the church because he knows he's there. He has kind of a recognition of him, but he,
yeah,
you know, I don't know. Like, that just seems to make more sense to me, because his like his wound is kind of hidden a little bit in that way, so it's not exactly apparent. In the way,
yeah, yeah, well,
the other ones
either
are.
That or, I mean, I don't know how easy it is for him to separate
screaming
dead,
at him?
Like
sure,
dead people from
at him whenever they meet him.
Yeah,
from other, real
well,
people.
I mean, a few of them do, but like, it's like that kid who's like,
yeah,
I'll show you where my dad's gun is. It's like that seems horrifying, because it's like, oh my god, like the like back of his head's blown off, and like that's a horrible thing to see as a child. So
yeah,
that made sense to me, where he's just like traumatized by like seeing something extremely gross like that. But
yeah, and I think there's other things that could kind
yeah
of, I mean, like the when he sees the mom, he thinks that's his mom until she turns
yeah
around and she's like screaming at him. So you could,
yeah, exactly. So I think
it.
I don't know how easy it is for him to separate real people from dead people, to be honest. Like, if Bruce
yeah
Willis looks well enough like a real person and doesn't do anything overtly scary and seems to be like kind of normal, then maybe for him he also seems like a normal person. I don't know if he, like, none of the dead people have like anything like around their heads signifying they're dead or something like that, though, like a halo or whatever. They're just like regular people until they turn around and have like their head blown off. And since he's wearing like an overcoat most of the time, it's not even apparent that he's dead. So I don't even know if it's that obvious to Haley Joel Osment that Bruce Willis is dead.
Like I said, that's not my problem with the script, but
yeah,
I do think that it's a plot hole. I thought of those arguments. I don't buy them.
Mm,
I think we're seeing
yeah
a different version of Bruce Willis than...
Sure, sure.
Than
that's
he
what
does.
He says when they're like, he sees whatever he wants to see. So, yeah,
yeah,
maybe it's... Yeah.
Maybe. Who knows?
So,
I don't know. A back wound like that wouldn't frighten me as much as like somebody having half their face burned off or whatever.
Sure,
that lady's not scary.
She's yeah
nice.
She's not, she's nice, but
she's
but if she just
makeup
showed up, if you just turned around and she was there, like, that would be pretty scary.
If I saw dead people walking around, I gotta be honest, every single one of them would scare me equally as much. It wouldn't matter if they like died, you know, in their sleep from a heart condition, or if they had no legs and were crawling towards me with their arms. I'd be like, I don't want to see the dead people. I don't like it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Stop talking to me, weirdo.
Fair enough.
I like that his dad's a ghost. That's cool. Not literally, but figuratively.
Yeah.
Mm. He's not in the movie, man.
Yep. Yeah,
his, the remnants of his things are around. I was like, oh yeah, that's a nice narrative connection as well. But
another art direction thing I like is it's one of the very first shots of the movie. I think it's like she's in the light bulb shot and she's in the wine cellar, and then like the moment she comes upstairs, it like goes over the mantle and you see all these drawings from kids, but it's not their kids. It's kids that he's helped, and I was like, oh. That's upsetting. Like, does she want kids? Does she look at that every day?
Yeah. And there's something, too, like, a little unsettling about just the idea of, I guess, like, children kind of having this thing where they, like, have to interact with adults even when they don't want to. Like, not just dead adults, but just adults in general. Right? That seems more upsetting to me. Like, just thinking about, like, oh, well, if an adult comes up and talks to you as a child, you can't just be like, leave me alone, go away. Like, then you're a bad kid. And it's like, no, you have to be nice to the adults. Even if you don't want these adults to talk to you as a child, like, you don't yet have the, I guess, like, the social...
permission?
Well, not necessarily permission, but just, like, the language even to, like, be like... That's cool. Like, I kind of don't want to talk to you or whatever. Like, you don't understand the, like, social politics of, like, getting out of a conversation yet. You're just like, I'm a child and I don't want to talk to you. And that's it. Like, that's as far as I can explain to you why I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah. But I'm parents 35 also... and I still don't have that skill. Also, I still get captive conversations.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Constantly.
Like, you might have the skill to do it if your parents, like, before any gathering with, like, a bunch of adults were like, hey, there's going to be a lot of family members here and they're going to want to say hello to you and hug you and kiss you. And if you don't want to, that's okay. You just have to tell them that you're not up for it right now. And if
you need that help.
Talk to me.
Basically. Yeah.
Yeah, most of the time children don't get that. They're just like,
yeah.
Say hello to, you know, whoever, you know, say hello to your aunt, or whatever. Yeah. Like, even if you don't want to.
It was interesting. Well, this is sort of getting back to a different point that we made earlier that I meant to comment on, but that I can see the kind of precedence for the Babadook in this. It's like, mom. Sure. Becoming a pariah because her son is one, and that feeling very sad, and the kind of struggles to deal with that, and like there's an interesting kind of back and forth balance that is uncomfortable where she's really struggling and then she's also like putting a lot of pressure on him to help her out, and that's not exactly like a fair thing to do to your like 9 or 10 year old son, but it's also like, I don't know, a pretty hard thing not to do if you're in a single parent household. Like, if you're, I don't know. My mom didn't have a lot of friends when I was growing up. She was just her and us. And there are definitely moments that later in life I realized, oh, my mom was really being emotionally unfair to me right then. But, you know, she's just a regular person. She doesn't have a lot of people helping her out, and her kids are right there.
And like, or at least it seems like Toni Collette's character is poor, and using all of her money to send Cole to a good school.
Right.
Any money that she can scrape together to send
with a bunch of asshole parents and asshole kids.
Working two jobs.
Yeah, I mean, when their heating dies, Cole literally wears, like, gloves, like, oversized gloves and stuff.
Or he wears boots. He wears boots on his hands.
Yeah.
He has boots on his hands. She's like, get them off the table.
Yeah.
Those are gloves. They're just, like, very big, like, leather gloves.
I thought so as well.
I think they're also his dad's gloves.
Doesn't he have, like, a shoe? I thought he has, like, a shoe in his hand at one point. He throws it at the TV.
Oh, that's another situation. Yeah. That's when he was watching that commercial.
Yeah, that's right before, but then after that, he's just wearing big, like,
Mommy, Daddy, my throat hurts.
Yeah, fuck that
guy. That's a very funny commercial.
Yeah, no, I love the cut to, like, just Cole watching it. He just throws the shoe at the TV. It's like, it's a good cut.
Yeah, his mom barely admonishes him for it. But yeah, fuck that kid. I get you.
We went way past the scene, but I agree with Basil that scene moves too fast, where the dad realizes that his wife and the mother of his children has killed his daughter. Yeah. One thing that I really like about that scene is that it does two smart things, I think. One is that it doesn't cut away from the dad, like, to show the reactions of the other people there who are watching it. And yet, also, it's so well directed, the scene, that you can see in their hands and their feet that they are watching it. They're not just standing there. Like, they've been directed to, like, be like, what the fuck are we watching?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's cool. That's like, you know, so many other directors would feel like, oh, we got to show what's happening when the emotional core of the scene is obviously the dad. And then even if they were smart enough to be like, no, we got to stay on the dad, they wouldn't be smart enough to, like, direct extras. To
and before that, when Haley Joel Osment hands him the tape, it also, like, it never cuts to the face of the dad reacting to him ever. He just, like, stands there for a while, like, trying to, like, tell him that he should see this tape. And you don't really see anything else happening except, like, he's always, like, holding out that tape for a while. And I thought that was also, like, a pretty good, interesting decision, because usually you'd expect them to cut to the dad's face and as he, like, reaches for the tape or something, and it doesn't happen here. It waits out his reaction until he watches the thing, and I think that that's a really effective way of doing that. So it's a well-directed scene, even though I, you know, disagree with maybe how that would actually work out in real life, but fair enough.
Yeah. But I think, it's interesting also to me that I'm struggling to come up with specific examples, but I remember recalling that, like, there's pretty good use of long takes throughout the movie, and one of the earliest ones is the, like, cupboard scene or whatever when she's doing the laundry. So, like, watching that, which was, like, a very ostentatious, obvious one, I was like, uh-oh, this movie's gonna have, like, a lot of annoying long takes. But then throughout the rest of the movie, like, they're actually pretty subdued. And the times when, you know, it takes a long time without cutting away from things, it does some things with, like, performances, but I'm struggling to remember moments. But I remember there being, like, well, one of them I think is Toni Collette when she's crying near the end of the movie. I was like, well, this is like a, this is a, there's not very much cutting. She's really just given this cry. It's very intense and sad to watch. And I felt like that, at least, I was like, this shouldn't work because this dialogue is very corny, but I'm feeling her performance, so I'm on board.
I like Toni Collette.
Yeah, she's great.
It's interesting too. Like,
she's back, baby.
I was gonna say, like, it's interesting thinking about her in this movie and thinking about her in Hereditary, where she's, like, essentially kind of in the same position, although, like, maybe not as not a poor single mother, but still a mother of, I guess you would say, like, troubled child. But, like, how completely different the performance is in that movie. And how that one actually comes off more comical in a way than this one, somehow.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. It's just weird to think about. Like, I guess if you want to make a low-budget horror movie that makes a shitload of money, you gotta call Toni Collette or Vera Farmiga, because they're gonna bring in the bucks.
Yeah, Hereditary made a bunch, too.
Yep. They do nothing but hits.
Let me look over my notes to see if I have anything else I have to say about this movie.
Haley said she could never take Bruce Willis seriously because he has, like, a smirk on his face all the time. And I was like, that's just his face. You're judging him for his resting yeah. face.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fair point.
I was going to say, if you like his performance in this, you should probably rewatch Unbreakable because he sighs like two or three times as many times.
Yeah.
If you're like, I like when he sighs after every line. It's like, how would you like if he sighs before, in the middle of, and after the line?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I'm not sure I think I like him as an actor. I think for whatever this role is supposed to do, it seems like he's cast pretty well.
Yeah, I actually think that he has very good chemistry with Haley Joel.
Yeah, I agree.
They're similar to what I just said about Toni Collette. I think there are parts where the dialogue was very corny to me, but something about their interactions made me believe it in spite of that. And I was like, this is nice. They're talking. And I like the way that Haley Joel Osment kind of vacillates between seeming like an adult and talking like an adult and also talking like a kid. I felt like that was like a pretty good and realistic way to depict, well, like children in general, but I think especially like children who have experienced like a kind of trauma that makes them feel like they have to grow up quickly, like they don't get to be kids anymore. His kind of precociousness is rooted in something really sad instead of like cutesy, like most movies.
Right.
And I dug that.
Yeah. I do like that he's not just like an endless fount of, you know, like,
did you know
witticisms
that...
or whatever.
I was worried for a second when he started talking Latin in the very first scene that we meet him basically talking Latin. I'm like, oh God, please don't speak Latin the whole movie. That was going to be fucking weird. And he never does again.
It could even be a joke on that type of character because he's wearing those glasses in the first scene. And he's oh, I don't really need them. I took the lenses out because they hurt my eyes. But he looks basically like the kid from Jerry Maguire.
Yeah.
And then he takes them off. Looks like a normal kid.
Yep.
All snowflakes do have six sides. The human head does weigh 8 pounds.
You had anything else, Ruben?
I like the way that this movie uses green screen. Normally when you have like a shot of like two people or whatever, and then it's just like their house or apartment has been green screened in, you're like, oh, this was done because it's cheap. But here it actually makes like a lot of aesthetic sense about these like people and their environments and like how Cole was connected to an environment in a way that other people, like specifically Bruce Willis's character, definitely isn't, but other characters like more emotionally aren't. It does a lot of diopter shots, which I think is cool. It's
a lot of what kind of shots?
Diopter, where you like cut two shots together to make them look like one really deep focus shot, but it's actually two normal lens shots stitched together for a similar kind of like split world feeling. It's a cool looking movie. I think M. Night Shyamalan may have script issues. I mean, I think he does, but it's a good movie.
Yeah,
he puts a lot of thought into the way that his movies look. Ways which I wish other directors.
Tak Fujimoto.
Yeah.
I do wish they wouldn't use that cheesy like post slow mo though. The cheesy post slow mo always bothers me.
Yeah, I like it in Hong Kong movies because they lean into how cheesy it is usually. But most other movies, I find it a little.
The worst offender I can think of is In the Mood for Love. That uses it way too much, and I hate it.
Yeah, well, speaking of earnest people, that's...
do we know what we're doing next week? Is it one of the new movies yet?
Yeah, it's going to be Hold the Dark, I think. Dark. Oh, no, wait, no, it's whatever...
Bad Times.
It's Patrick's next pick.
Okay. The next
thing. So we don't know.
Whichever one. Yeah. I'll have to look at the votes.
Another AFI
votes
movie
are
coming
in.
Up
I've
next
gotta,
week.
I've just got to tap.
Oh, yeah.
Count them up.
All right, so I guess you guys will just have to wait until the episode comes out to know what to watch, but we will be doing Hold the Dark and Bad Times at El Royale and First Man all right in a row after whatever boom, boom, Patrick's boom, pick boom. Is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So. All 2018, all the time, baby.
Classic movie. I actually think there may be it may be a very easy tabulation because I think everybody.
Okay. While you're doing that, I'll do the closing thing where I say thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. If so, please subscribe using your podcast listening application. Give us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. And check out all of our content on loosecannons.net. And give us money on patreon.com.
And I know what movie it's going to be. It's going to be the original 1933 King Kong.
Cool. Wow.
Two people Boom. Put it first and one person put it second. So it wins.
There you go.
Kong.
Watch that movie, guys.
Woo!
And all right. Yep.
And non-binary people.
Mary, yep. See. Koopa.
Every folks.
All right. Okay. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.